From the Mutual Broadcasting System, this is STRAT, Strategic Risk Assessment Talk. Now, retired Marine Intelligence Officer and globally recognized risk expert, Hal Kempfer.
Welcome to STRAT, Strategic Risk Assessment Talk, and today I'm going to discuss something that's been in the news. You know, interesting, of all the things that happen, all the shootings that happen on a regular basis, but all the horrific actions, this one only resulted in two deaths, although they're both children, and a horrific, tragic situation. Now, with that said, there were a lot of very serious injuries that took place from this, but it is being looked at as a domestic terrorism by the FBI. And in many ways, what we're discovering, even in the very recent, like day after sort of stuff, is that this is really, I don't know of any other way to call it. It's a domestic intelligence breakdown, failure, something. But the real issue is the fundamentals of why did we miss this threat? Why did we not assess this individual as potentially being a threat to either himself or society? Why did we miss that? And what is wrong with our system that we keep missing these types of individuals that are threats? Why aren't we intervening early? And I'm not necessarily talking, you know, sometimes you'll hear law enforcement say, hey, we have to arrest them. You know, there's nothing to charge them with because they haven't committed a crime. To which I say, well, you know, crime prevention is about making sure they don't commit a crime. And if it's a violent act of domestic terrorism, I would say that is a very, very important area of crime prevention, is stopping that. You know, we used to say this after 9/11, that our mission was to stop the next 9/11. I think that has been lost a bit. So I'm going to spend some time talking about this. Of course, what I'm talking about is a horrific terrorist attack that we just saw at a Catholic school in Minneapolis. Now, let's kind of do a little recap here if we could. There was an armed assailant. That we had three guns, had a shotgun, a handgun, and what appears, as far as I can tell from the news, I may be corrected tomorrow, some type of assault-type weapon, assault, a magazine-fed semi-automatic weapon is what it looked like. Not quite clear what it is. Could be an AR-15. I don't know. We'll find out. That isn't quite clear yet. He fired through stained glass windows at a Catholic church where there were children going, you know, parish school children, students were attending Mass on Wednesday, August 27th. In the melee, he shot about 20 people. And I say about 20, there was some late word as I was recording this that there was one person that was in the original count of 19 that may have been taken by private ambulance to a hospital in another city. And for whatever reason, they missed that person, that child in the account. But it's about 20 people. Two of them were children that were killed. Of the 17 others, 14 were children, and with that last person I just talked about, that'd make 15 if it was a total of 20. That is a huge active shooting scenario, if you will, or active shooting situation. It's just a sheer horror. And for so many of us out there who have had children, you know, in school, we dread this probably more than anything else in the world. Because when we take them to school, we like to think they're going to be safe at school. But, of course, we all know the reality is that these things happen. And, of course, the other person that was killed was the assailant. I'll get to that. Anyway, the shooting ended when the lone suspect, identified as Robin Westman, age 23, took his own life at the rear of the church. Right? And initially, law enforcement didn't want to talk about a motive for the attack. However, there was lots of stuff that Westman had posted on live. Now, I should mention, Robin Westman used to be Robert Westman, and he was identified as a woman. He was transgender, and yes, there is a lot of stuff on the internet that's focusing on the transgender aspects of this, and I think there's a lot more to this issue than just, I'm sure the transgender piece is part of it, but there's a lot more to this issue, if you will, as to the indicators that were missed. All right. There was a videotape message by the suspect say that he had struggled with depression, and also he was fascinated with the perpetrators of mass shootings. Again, I kind of wonder about his online activity and wonder if there's, and it's starting to look like there was a lot of stuff out there that just wasn't being looked at, assessed, or understood, particularly by those around him. And I'm going to look at the family. In so many of these cases, the family were seeing it, but they were in somewhat disbelief that, their son or daughter or whatever was capable of doing this, and they don't report to anybody. And of course, we always find out after the horrific events afterwards. His mother had worked for years at that school up till 2021, and he was a student at that school up through the eighth grade. Now, FBI Director Kash Patel has said his agency was investigating this attack as an act of domestic terrorism and a hate crime targeting Catholics. And I think both of those, based on everything I see, are very fair assessments of what we're looking at in these situations. He had posted a couple of videos on YouTube, taken down quickly, and a manifesto of sorts that explained his hatred of Catholics, but also, from what I understand, his hatred of Jews, racial minorities, hatred of politicians, particularly Donald Trump. There was just a lot of hatred all around. This person was dealing with some very serious psychological issues and had manifested this into a broad array of hate things across the board. Obviously, there's something very wrong with anyone who would go to a school and a Catholic school and would shoot up or shoot small children. Anybody in there has so many levels of something is not right, if you want to put that out. Something's horribly wrong that, yeah, it's just, it to me, it almost seems impossible that those around that person could not have picked up on indicators that there was something this wrong before they did this. Now, you may recall that in 2023, there was another attack took place at a Christian school, a Catholic school in Tennessee, that where the shooter was also transgender. In that case, my recollection, in this case, it was a male transitioning to a woman. In that case, it was a woman transitioning to a male. But that also, you know, it's just one aspect of this terrorist attack. There have been a lot of single-issue extremists, you know, anti-Muslim, anti-Semitic, anti-Jewish, I should say, you know, white supremacists, you name it. There's a lot of violent extremism out there. This is a pretty small category as far as I've seen so far. And then I also look at, you know, what happened in Santa Barbara and later Toronto with the incel killers, or, you know, the what they call involuntary celibate. We saw that for a while. There was some speculation that maybe there's a connection with the incel movement being tied to terrorism. I don't know if it was tied to terrorism. I would say there were individuals that had a lot of other psychological problems. If you look at what happened with the individual in Santa Barbara, he had a long, long history of huge psychological problems prior to moving to Santa Barbara, prior to obviously that deadly attack. And so I kind of look at this to say, you know, yeah, that's just one part of all the motivations that got them to that place, but it's a part that was missed, and that's not really what I want to talk about more than anything else. What needs to be focused on are the warning signs, the pre-incident indicators, the things that said they were going down this violent trajectory, if you will. All right, they obviously didn't get properly. They probably were observed, but may not have been understood, or they were underassessed or improperly assessed, but they didn't drive action to intervene. They didn't drive action to mitigate this situation before it became a horrific event. One of the things that I've run into for years, and I've been doing training with public safety and stuff for decades on this, and have trained tens of thousands of law enforcement on this issue of terrorism. One of the problems is if the training on recognition signs, if the training on what to do once you observe these things, if that is solely focused on law enforcement, 99.9%+ of the population is those who will observe these warning signs are not going to get any of this stuff. And that's what often happens, is we miss those individuals. I've often felt it's just as important to train educators, school teachers, school staff, you know, people working in health or other sorts of things, in many cases, to train them to observe this stuff, because frankly, they may have a higher propensity of contact with some of these individuals, and if they don't know, they won't report it. And I have to tell you, there are things like the HIPAA laws, which really, you know, restrict what can be shared, you know, the protecting patients' privacy rights. But there are exceptions to HIPAA, and one of the exceptions has to deal with if you interpret that they pose a threat to themselves or others. And so I think there needs to be much wider scale training. I don't think it needs to be as much as we give law enforcement, but it needs to be out there and it needs to be more. And this very much appears to be the situation today. I look at this thing, I'm thinking that there are those who saw what, or heard or saw or read what Westman was going through, and they just didn't do anything about it. All right. And as we've said about terrorists, domestic terrorists, you know, lone wolves like Westman, before they're acting out in the real world, they're usually venting like crazy in the virtual world. I think we missed this again. Now, there's numerous models of terrorism, radicalization process, steps to violent extremism. You will see this venting process explicitly mentioned. You'll often see less significant but noteworthy wrongful acts prior to the big deadly attack, and I'm pretty sure we're going to probably see that here as well. You know, the thing is, we need to make sure, you know, when you talk about stopping this stuff, preventing the next one, part of it is we need to look in the right places, but with the right understanding. Obviously, tools like artificial intelligence can play a big part. There is an initiative in the wake of this where they're going to be using AI to scour the internet looking for hate language, symbology, all sorts of things associated with violent extremism. And I think that's good. I think it's a broad net. I'm a little concerned that we might start bringing in a lot of folks who are not intending on doing something violent or some sort of terrorist act, and look at them in the same vise, in the same, you know, same visor, if you will, or the same glasses or whatever, seeing them in the same way that we'd see someone who is a bona fide would-be terrorist. However, it could be very helpful in that regard, and it can, and AI can, you know, honestly look at a lot more stuff than a human can possibly ever look at, or humans can possibly look at on the internet. Part of this is making sure we have the right people in the right place, the right skill sets and knowledge that can identify these threats, figure out strategies, tactics to mitigate, prevent these sorts of attacks. The other part is, and this is the biggest part, in public safety, is having a system of metrics, a system of measures of effectiveness that recognizes and rewards successful mitigation and prevention. You know, even after this many, what, 20, almost a quarter century after 9/11, if I look at the metrics, they're still kind of the traditional metrics. How many arrests? How many convictions? What type of convictions did you get? How many felonies? What type of felonies? And these are enforcement statistics. You know, going out there and, you know, on this day in this place, nothing happened. Well, that's a success. If there was statistically a chance of something happening and nothing happened, that's a success. We just don't have a good way of measuring that. We don't, you know, and some of that, it takes a lot of thought. And I can count up things. If you arrest somebody, I can count up the number of arrests that day very easily. If you make a dope bust, I can count out how many kilograms, you know, of cocaine that you brought in, okay, and how many arrests you made, and how much money you seized, or whatever. Those are easy metrics. They've been around for decades and decades and decades and decades. That's as long as we've had law enforcement. We've been tracking that stuff. They've been around. But when you're talking about preventing violent attacks, like what we just saw in Minneapolis, we don't do that. And because we don't reward that sort of mitigation prevention, it's not surprising that we're just not, that we're seeing these attacks happen over and over again. Those activities, those actions, the knowledge, expertise necessary to do that, they are not getting rewarded. And we've seen this with a watering down of the process. You know, after 9/11, my director, Robert Mueller, talked about a meeting he had with the cabinet, and he was there with President George W. Bush. And George Bush looked at him and he said, so what are we going to do about this? And he looked directly at Mueller. And Mueller started rattling out, well, we're opening this investigation. We're doing this. We're doing that. We're going to go back and look at where these guys came from. We're going to do all this stuff. He mentioned everything that was right from a Federal Bureau of Investigation. They were investigating the crime that took place. And finally, George Bush reportedly stopped him and said, I'm not asking you what you're doing about the attack that took place. You know, you're not going to arrest those guys. They're dead. They died in the attack. I'm talking about what are you doing to prevent the next one? And Mueller was somewhat dumbfounded. He goes, well, sir, that's not what the FBI does. He says, well, I don't care what you think the FBI does. That's what we need done. And that was a turning point. And there was a turning point nationwide. Prevent the next 9/11. But that was, as I mentioned, almost a quarter century ago. Now, the Homeland Security Intelligence Fusion Centers, I've worked with that program for many years, done a lot of things with them. They originally were stood up, not right away, took about 4, 5, 6 years before they got stood up after 9/11, but they got stood up, and they originally brought in a lot of very impressive talent. They brought in folks from the intelligence community, they brought in folks with tremendous analytical skills. You know, some of the fusion centers actually had staff psychologists that actually sat there, and they would look at these individuals. And they were really aimed at prevention. But over time, as I mentioned, those metrics haven't shifted or kept up with what we want done. If you're looking at prevention and there's no way that prevention is rewarded or recognized or seen as valid as metrics, unlike arrests, stuff like that, well, it kind of drifted the other way. And a lot of that really good talent has moved on. They got out of the fusion centers and went other directions. And many of them went back to Washington, D.C., got on with other parts of the intelligence community where they felt their talents were, you know, certainly, you know, recognized, rewarded, and there was a career path that they could actually follow. And if you look at the fusion centers today, a lot of them just, they have gaps. You know, I know of some psychologists that worked with the fusion centers. They don't work with the fusion centers. I ask them, well, what happened? They said, well, when I left, they didn't bring anybody in to replace me. And I said, well, how'd it go before you left? They go, well, that was one of the reasons I left. They didn't know how to use me. I was underutilized or misutilized. I was doing a lot of stuff that was not really what I was there to do. And, of course, while they were there, bad things happened, but nobody recognized why they were there or what it was to do that. And this really goes back to a concept before 9/11 called the terrorism early warning, hence the term early warning. The whole focus there was early warning to prevent these horrible things from happening. That was the primary thing. So it was kind of missed. All right. Now, there's a lot of federal money that went with the whole Homeland Security thing. And like any federal money, I think it was a famous senator once said, any program where you have a lot of federal money and really poor oversight, you're going to have corruption. There in some cases, I know for a fact there was actual corruption. But in many cases, the funding just went a different direction. And look, if I'm a police chief and I find out that I can put, you know, 6 of my officers on a federal grant, all I have to do is say that they work on some intelligence thing or something like that. And I go, great. So I get those guys off of the funding that I have to fight tooth and nail with the city council to get to pay for these guys every year. I'll put them over here. So maybe I can put 6 guys on the grant. I'll hire 3 new people and I'll have more sworn officers in total. That sounds great. The problem is this. You still have to do the same number of patrols. You have to do the same number of people on the streets. So what you'll end up doing is you put these guys over on the grant, and then they on the weekends and stuff, they'll come over and do patrols and stuff, but they're on overtime. And when you start doing the whole cost accounting thing at the end, you find out you're not saving anything. In fact, you didn't save the city a penny. You got a little bit bigger department because you put these guys on the grant, but actually what you did was you end up costing taxpayers, particularly city taxpayers, county taxpayers, others, more money because of this little shell game with moving people over. And more importantly, you put people over there doing stuff for which they weren't actually trained. That's not their area of expertise. You know, one would say, I've heard this before many times going back 30 years. Well, you know, all police officers are intelligence officers. Not true. All right. Some are, some aren't. But that is not true. Okay. That's, Marine Corps, we say every Marine's a rifleman. Well, there's a certain amount of truth there, but I will tell you, as somebody who started in the infantry, you know, the grunts that I served with are a heck of a lot more capable, well-trained, you know, dangerous on the battlefield to the enemy than just grabbing my average Marine and saying, here, go do this, all right? There are skill sets, and there are things that you do when you train to do that. And if you need intelligence folks, you need intelligence folks who are trained in intelligence. So this shell game thing sounds great in theory. I hear some sort of broad platitudinous things, but at the end of the day, we end up with the wrong people in the wrong places, and we don't have the right people that we need to do those things. And at the end of the day, you end up with a situation like Minneapolis. And I think that we need to dive into this. I think we need to dive into some other things that have taken place in the past. And we need to recognize that we've had a problem here. And it's not saving us any money. It's not doing us any good. In fact, what's happening is it just gets worse and worse every year. And there's a saying we say in risk management that, you know, and we see it a lot with the maritime community, or we see it with aviation. Aviation has some pretty strict rules, but maritime we see it where a ship will get away with, you know, the crew will get away with doing something without going through all the proper steps. They get away with it once and they go, well, hey, we got away with it. Do it again. Hey, look, we got away with it. A lot of times it's tied to maintenance or training or something. And they got away with it. And then one time they don't get away with it. And that one time they don't get away with it, it is absolutely catastrophic. In some cases, they lose the entire ship and crew. That's what we got to look at here. We got to avoid these catastrophic events from happening. You know, we need to look at some of these things when they say, oh, I got X number of officers, and actually look at, well, are they on the streets, or do you have them doing other things for which they are not the best fit? And we need to ask that across the country. And a lot of those ostensive savings that they think they're getting for the department are not saving anything. And we need to take a hard look at that. And again, when you look at what happened in Minneapolis, that should be a wake-up call. I'd be curious to look at the Fusion Center in Minneapolis, in Minnesota, and see who's there and what they're doing at any given day and what's happening. And I do recall after January 6th, I was one of the few that looked at the Fusion Center in Washington, D.C., and I was trying to identify what they were focused on. Keep in mind, this is the unclassified thing. This is their public face. They were looking at car warranty scams. That was the thing they had on their Fusion Center. It was like their top priority. And I go, well, maybe that's why you missed what just happened down at the Capitol. Maybe that's why you didn't put out the right warning on stuff like that, was because you were basically, you know, paying homage to some short-term, politically convenient sort of thing that was causing you some local pain and missing your primary mission, all right? And if we want to avoid Minneapolis's, San Bernardino, Inland Regional Centers, Palm Springs Fertility Clinics, Borderline Club and Grills, and a host of other domestic terror events, we need to go back to the fundamentals. Who do we have doing what? How is it getting done? And is it preventing these deadly attacks from happening? And if the answer is it's not really working the way it was supposed to work, then we need to fix it. And we pay a huge price for allowing that sort of problem to continue. Anyway, hope I didn't sound too political on this, but I did want to talk structural. I want to talk real world stuff, a real world problem. And it's because we had a horrible attack. And my mind is with the parents and families of those children that were shot, that were killed. And I look at the horrific tragedy that took place there. And I know what part of the problem is. Now, if we did everything I just talked about, does that guarantee that this wouldn't have happened? No, there's no 100% guarantee. Could it have reduced the chance of this happening by 90%, 95%, maybe more? Quite possibly. And I think we need to go back and look at things like that. Anyway, thanks for listening to Strategic Risk Assessment Talk. Obviously, this was Strategic Risk Assessment, and that's what I've been talking about. And I'm saying that we need to do better in the future. please visit stratpodcast.com. Visit my YouTube page at Hal Kiempfer TV, or go to my corporate website at Global Risk or GRIPSA.com for Global Risk Intelligence and Planning. And hope to see you or have you there for the next one.